We do have our guest with us now, I believe. Alex?
Right here.
Alex, thank you very much for joining us. Alex Coburn, one of America's best-known investigative journalists, columnist for The Nation, and the co-editor with Jeffrey St. Clair of the muckraking newsletter Counterpunch. Alex, it's a real honor to have you on the show. I've been reading you for a couple decades, going back to the Village Voice and the Wall Street Journal days. And I just want to let everyone know, first of all, that one way to stay on top of Alex's work is through his superb newsletter that he publishes, Counterpunch, which is also available online and is updated daily. And as many articles from a heterogeneous group of left and critical journalists and commentators. And I'd urge people to check it out. And the website address, I think, is www.counterpunch.org. Is that correct?
Counterpunch.
Counterpunch.
Not Counterpunch.
No, yeah, well, you know, I've been drinking to get ready for the show. Well, Alex, you've got a new book out, too, that you're editing, The Politics of Anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I should say right away that all my Counterpunch work and the book is done co-editing with Jeffrey Sinclair, whose work you know, who actually does the grunt work of getting the site up, and I did the book with him. So.
Okay, yeah, let's give Jeff due notice here.
Take our hats off to Jeff there.
Absolutely.
Sitting in Oregon City. And I'm in Northern California. And the book is The Politics of Anti-Semitism, and it's actually a bunch of pieces, about 15 pieces, which are on the site and in the newsletter, addressing this issue of the political uses of anti-Semitism, which I'll explain in a second. But it's essays by the late Edward Said, Kathy and Bill Christensen, who were very senior CIA people at one point, Norman Finkelstein, Robert Fisk, Lenny Brenner, Yuri Avneri, and Jeffrey and myself and others. And it really goes to this business about if you're critical of what Israel's doing, if you're critical of what actually existing Zionism is in Israel and the territories, you get called an anti-Semite. That's one of the takeoff points for the book. As you well know, it's a slur that's easily used. And it's been used so much over the last 20 years, actually, it's getting kind of devalued as a way of silencing people. But we've seen it used against people like McKinney in Georgia and Hilliard in Alabama at the congressional level, whereby people in the Israel lobby or the ADL or whoever just go after people who they think are criticizing Israel. And, of course, there's a lot to criticize Israel for these days. In fact, one of the rules I've developed over the years is that the worse Israel's behaving, particularly under the appalling criminal Sharon, the more you tend to see these charges of anti-Semitism being brought out as a way to try and beat back criticism.
And along these lines, you've recently had an exchange with Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, who has written a book, I think, pertinent to this subject.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly, that's kind of a side issue. I mean, Dershowitz wrote a truly stupid book called The Case for Israel, which has actually got criticized in the Jewish press as being really just a rehash of the most sort of second-rate, you know, Zionist propaganda. You know, there's hardly a true line in the whole book. And Finkelstein, actually, Norman, discovered in the first two chapters of Dershowitz's book there were an incredible number of plagiarisms from actually a really fraudulent book of its own right called From Time Immemorial by Joan Peters, which was published in the early 80s, which was ecstatically greeted by the New York Times and other publications at the time, which basically said that, first of all, Palestine was empty, and then the Zionists came at the turn of the century. And as Israel Zangwill put it, they found a land without people waiting for a people without land, which is the famous old Zionist tag. And then, of course, there were the Zionists in the land of Israel, and then the Arabs, seeing opportunity, economic opportunity, came in to get work. So really the thesis was that there were no Arabs in Palestine before the Jews returned to it. Anyway, this silly book got put away in the middle 80s by Norman Finkelstein and a guy called Porath in the New York Review of Books. But there's Dershowitz, who makes a great show of having, you know, historical sources and scholarly basis for his mad claims. He's actually taken them all without accreditation from Peters. And so Norman did some of the work, and I pointed, most of the work actually, and then I pointed this out in The Nation, and then Dershowitz wrote a tendentious letter, as you might expect from an attorney. I mean, and also from a, Yale, a Harvard law professor, and I rebutted his defense. And I think we need not expect that Larry Summers, the president of Harvard, will dismiss Dershowitz for plagiarism. Probably would have dismissed a student, but Dershowitz isn't a student. He's the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law, and therefore there's a different set of standards applying.
We're talking to Alex Coburn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in, you have a question or comment, the number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Do you think that criticism of Israel is the most controversial issue you touch on in your writing?
Or the... It's up there with, yeah, I would guess. It's when I did a lot of work on contesting this satanic abuse of kids stuff, that's a hot-button issue, too. I'd say, yeah. I mean, people, since I've done it for years and years and years, I think a lot of people who would go berserk with other people, they think, oh, there's El Coburn, he's a hardened offender, so they don't speak up as much as if it was someone else. But yeah, it absolutely is.
You know, as I know on this show, I've done it now for about a year and a half, and it's the one issue that has generated a lot of phone calls. And I've had guests who've made comments similar to the ones you just made. That, you know, the phone lines usually heat up, and maybe because it's you who's made them, they've yet to heat up. Your reputation has preceded you, perhaps. But it certainly seems to be the most, I mean, someone can get up and call for a world revolution and get a yawn from our audience. But
I could see why. You know, by the way, I should say to people, if they want this book, they can call up our Counterpunch, either email Counterpunch or just call up our 800 number, which I can give whenever you want me to give it, assuming you're allowed to ask for it.
Yeah, sure, go right ahead. You just can't mention the price, otherwise you're welcome to give all that information.
Oh, I see. Well, all right, for a very modest sum.
Okay, you're allowed to say that.
A modest sum. You can dial 1-800-840-3683, 1-800-840-3683, and get a copy of this terrific book.
And also the website is www.counterpunch.org. And it's updated constantly, and I strongly recommend it for people who want a provocative dose of journalism every day.
Well, yeah.
Alex, let's talk about some big issues for a sec then. What's your sense of the state of journalism today in the United States, mainstream journalism, and how it compares to where it was 5 or 10 years ago?
I think mainly what's happened is that our side, and I'm going to say our side, even though that's, of course, a breach of, you know, objective credentials, I mean, are just better informed because of the Internet. I mean, I know that you and, you know, media critics like, you know, Solomon and, of course, Chomsky and all the rest of it, you know, constantly berate and bewail the state of the mainstream press. But it seems to me that we know so much more. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, I mean, by the way, to go directly to your question, the mainstream press seems to me roughly the same. I mean, you know, it goes up and down a little bit. I think they're gravely embarrassed, a lot of people, about the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. I think they do realize that they made a mess of things, and although they, you know, would never admit it. For example, I haven't seen too much of Judy Miller in the New York Times lately. I think she's under discipline. She was, of course, the woman who, primed by sources from the Iraqi exile movement, kept saying that there was a vast nuclear program. And I think the fact that they have not found weapons of mass destruction it's such an obvious disaster for the propagandists that it's having an effect. I mean, they'll always, next time the administration wants a war panic, they'll create one and it'll be back. They can always do it. It's not that hard. They did it very clumsily this time. And, of course, they've now run into a lot of trouble, which I think is politically damaging to Bush. But my feeling is now that, I mean, I find this when I go to meetings, and I say to people, let's say there are 200 people in the room, you know, on some college town, I say, people from the community, and people range up to 70, 75 years old, I say, how many people go on the net? And usually now it's about 95% of the people put their hands up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, if you're trying to find out stuff, you know, 15 years ago, I remember 20 years ago writing for The Voice, and you mentioned, you know, some article in The Independent in England. You know, you'd either have to rush out to the foreign newspaper store on Times Square, then write about it, quote it, but if anybody else then wanted to access that, almost no way they could do it. And we all remember trying to cram newsprint down fax machines. It was very laborious. Well, now you know, you can simply go and get all this stuff. I mean, I'm sure you're on a lot of listservs. I know I am. And, you know, I mean, just looking in my computer this morning, there's already about 3 reports of the shelling of the Rashid Hotel in Baghdad. So and also, you know, you've got specialist people like, for example, a Council on, Hemispheric Affairs, that outfit in Washington, Larry Burns' group that does good work on Latin America. You can go and be enormously well-informed on whatever issue you want. And that, I think, has made a staggering difference, and one that I think media critics very often just miss. I mean, in some ways, I mean, I get the New York Times headline service. You probably do, too. You're such an addict of these things, McChesney, that you probably read the whole thing from beginning to end. But I can look at the stories on the New York Times front page in 10 seconds, see mostly it's the same old drivel, and not be bothered with it. Just gives you a sense of what... I mean, the New York Times basically sets the discussion for what the Sunday shows are going to be talking about and what Washington is going to be talking about. I mean, that and the Washington Post. But, you know, we've got much more than we used to have, and I think that's a source of tremendous optimism.
How has it affected the political culture, do you think, in the United States?
Well, that's one of those questions. I don't know. I mean, you get these sort of flash flood type things going across the internet. I mean, I think for organizing around organizing against the war, I think it had a pretty good effect, you know, in kind of linking things up across the world when you've got that series of world demonstrations. I mean, it has a very good effect. I think virtual protest has its price. People kind of exaggerate what's actually happened. I mean, just because every progressive person in the universe is reading the same story on the web and getting mad about the same things doesn't mean that translates into political consequence, political effect, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in terms of generating knowledge about issues, whether it's media reform, which I heard you talking a little bit about when I came on the air,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, you know, it's pretty good. I mean, let's take, for example, the war against genetically managed crops, you know. 2 weeks ago in England, there was a devastating report put out by the by a scientific association. Actually, the most far-reaching examination of what actually happens with genetically manipulated seeds, which I don't know if it'll be a death blow to the attempts by Monsanto to introduce GM crops into Europe, but it certainly will have a very serious effect. Now, that will certainly go around the world and has gone around the world as a source of great encouragement to everybody battling GM crops. So it's as a basis of organizing. Or another thing, for example, we had a really good piece on Counterpunch the other day by Joanne Wippijewski, my editor formerly of The Nation, discussing these efforts by a number of powerful unions inside the AFL-CIO, like the SEIU, to kind of begin setting up some alternative outside the AFL-OL. Very long piece about labor. Now, as you know, discussion of labor issues in the mainstream press is next to zero. Labor unions are pretty much invisible. And, you know, you've got Steve Greenhouse in the New York Times and a few others, but most of these people don't know, short of the annual AFL-CIO bash down in Florida, and they don't really know at all what's going on. Now, that piece of Joanne's, which people, if they're interested, just go to the website and go to the search box and hit return, put in Wippijewski labor or something, that had a big effect inside the labor movement because it was the only place you could really find it. But in the end, of course, in organizing, you know, there's physical organizing to do and political incitement to do, and that doesn't always follow immediately on from just having a lot of access to the web.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. We're talking to Alex Coburn today, my guest on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a live show, so we're accepting phone calls. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number is 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Yeah, and I think that leads right into the next question, which is the state of left or progressive activism in the United States, empowered with all this much greater access to information, high-quality journalism than was possible 10 or 15 years ago. It is affecting organizing's ability in many issues. You've mentioned a couple of them, genetically modified food, the anti-war movement. When will it trickle up or translate up towards the electoral system that we will see alternatives running for office and maybe even winning?
Hard to say. I don't know. I mean, I think, well, I mean, look at the recent recall election in California, here in California.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a good green candidate in the form of Camejo.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you had, I don't like her at all. Some of the liberal left seem to be quite enamored of Arianna Huffington. I think I don't share that enthusiasm. I mean, she was very right-wing, and then when she'd collared enough of her former husband's money, she then headed towards a sort of populist center. And then she got into the race, and I think it didn't do Camejo any good. And then she got out of the race after a terrible performance in the debate, and then announced that she was going to, after years of writing that the two-party system is hopelessly corrupt, in the course of which, and she denounced tax loopholes, and it was disclosed she paid no federal taxes in 2002, and only no local taxes and only $731 in federal taxes. So to hear her denouncing loopholes is a bit ridiculous. And then she announced that she encouraged everybody to vote against recall and to vote for Bustamante, the Democrat, the machine Democrat. So that didn't do Camejo any good. But still, Camejo was a presence. He did well in the debate. In Santa Cruz County, which is about as green a county as you can find in California south of the Arcata Co-op, I mean, I think he got about 5,000 votes. Mm-hmm. Which is terrible. And now he had good presence on the web and the net. So certainly nothing on the web or the internet or electronic media really translated into political bang for Camejo. My own sense of it is, in fact, Jeffrey and I just wrote a piece in the newsletter, which is different from the website, by the way. If you go to the website, you don't find anything on the newsletter because, you know, you pay money for, well, almost nothing. You pay money for the newsletter. Our feeling is, you know, that people are so worked up about Bush that no matter what they say they're going to do. I mean, there was a poll just the other day, USA Today, I think, said 30% want Nader to run in 2004. I mean, very high percentage. But you can bet your boots when we get down to the wire, it'll make people who said the lesser of two evils back in 2000, that's going to be multiplied fourfold in 2004. I mean, I think people are kind of unhinged on Bush. He's awful, but I don't think the Wesley Clark, Michael Moore, who is becoming increasingly disgusting in his public positions.
Wesley Clark or Michael Moore?
Well, both of them, I think. They're kind of joined at the hip, aren't they? I mean, there's Moore on the stump for Wesley Clark, who is a complete madman, a NATO general who practically produced the Third World War during the attack on Yugoslavia. If you'll remember, he wanted to attacked the Russian unit that had taken over Pristina Airport, and the British general in charge of that sector said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be responsible for starting World War III on your orders. He actively disobeyed the supreme commander of NATO. It was a very scary moment. So here you've got a man as bad as Curtis LeMay in some ways, with Michael Moore running around. In a meeting the other day, he was denouncing Kucinich and, you know, putting Kucinich down.
Michael Moore was?
Yes, he was.
Where was this meeting?
I had a long account of it from a woman called Carol Wallman who was there. I'm not sure what state it was in. And he was going after Kucinich, of course, for his stand on choice, because Kucinich, you know, being a Catholic, has, a pro forma opposition to choice. But he said that, of course, if he was president, he wouldn't lift a finger to stop it and all the rest of it. However, and then, well, another thing Moore just went on record with, since we're talking about Michael Moore, is saying that he thinks Mumia Abu-Jamal probably did kill the policeman. Now, that's not very helpful to Mr. Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row, is it? So I hear you're stunned. You reel back. You don't know.
No, actually, I saw the piece that you published on Counterpunch about that by Dave Lindorf.
By Dave Lindorf, who did a wonderful book, by the way.
Yeah, who was actually a guest on the show talking about that book not long ago.
Oh, good for you. So anyway, I feel that people, or Dean, you know, all these people are pretty awful. But a lot of progressives are so wound up about Bush and talking about fascist coups and all the rest of it that they'll vote for anybody, and they will not vote for a third-party candidate.
Yeah, that's my sense too. But I take it you really don't think the Bush-Cheney regime or administration is that much of a divergence from what the Democrats would offer. I mean, that this alarm is necessarily justified.
I mean, I think they're a terrible crowd. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, but I think it's a little excessive, some of the talk about them in contrast to the Democrats. I mean, people forget that Al Gore, when he was on the stump in 2000, had exactly the same plan to attack Iraq and was stumping on saying, let's attack Iraq. I mean, it's very easy to forget what they're like. Look, put it another way. Paul Krugman has a popular book out called... of course, I said it's popular, and I can't remember the name of the book. Do you remember it?
No, I know. We're going to have Krugman on to talk about it. I don't remember.
It's called The Great Unraveling.
That's right.
And, you know, Paul Krugman is a guy who's very popular among liberals and Democrats because they feel there he is kicking ass in the New York Times every day. I mean, no, twice a week, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, if you read, I just read a column about this, which will be up on our site next week. If you go through that book, Krugman's position basically is life was terrific until January 2001, at which point it all fell apart economically. Now, there's no question, and then, of course, he spends column after column attacking the Bush tax plan, as well he might. But if someone of Krugman, and Krugman is, of course, a neoliberal and very much in sync with what the Clinton people were doing. But if you turn to, you know, the index and look up Argentina, or if you look and see, you know, look up Greenspan, you won't find any concession that actually Clintonomics in many ways were a disaster. They were very good for rich people, the same way as the Bush thing is. But in other ways, they left people as bad off as they were before. And basically, the Clinton administration was captured by Wall Street very early on. It's actually Bob Woodward I don't like his books, but his book, The Agenda, was a pretty good one, makes it absolutely clear. So I think as we go in, look, where are we now? We're in October 2003. And for people at this stage in the game to be saying anybody but Bush, any Democrat rather than Republicans, without asking what the economic policy is, without even critiquing Clintonomics properly, and there's a very good book, by the way, out on this by Robert Polin called Figures of Dissent. And if you want an education, just read Bob Polin's book and then read Krugman's book. And Polin's is infinitely better. But for people to be throwing in the towel on politics at this stage in 2003, in the fall, seems to me complete madness.
Do you have a horse in the Democratic race?
Do I have a horse?
Do you have someone? Do you have someone that you think is superior out of the pack of candidates there presently?
Oh, you mean among the Democrats?
Yeah, people? Among the Democrats.
Well, I mean, I'm not a fan of everything he does, but I mean, and I think the Sharpton campaign. I'm not going to say Sharpton because I think his campaign has been kind of pretty null, actually. But I mean, I think Kucinich probably is saying most of the stuff, more stuff that I would agree with, although I don't like all this thing about renaming the War Department the Peace Department or whatever. It seems to me silly. And there's kind of a woo-woo factor in Dennis. I mean, I've known Dennis for many years, ever since he was the mayor of Cleveland back in the middle 70s when he tried to protect the public power station there. But if you just look at him, I mean, and then look at the other ones. But, of course, what normally will happen is that Dennis will be in the race and then he'll stay in the race, and everybody will say, I delude themselves that he's going to win, which I don't think he can do because he hasn't got enough money, and he's not that brilliant a campaigner anyway. And then at the very end, round about Democratic convention time, he'll do exactly what, let's say, Jackson did. He'll say, rally behind the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then the Democratic National Committee will say, thank you very much, and they'll give him get out the vote money, which is the kind of stuff that Jackson got and he shoved in his pocket. And we'll be back where we started. That's why I'm always in favor of these third-party bids. But, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to see, I remember with the Ralph campaign in 2000, you had, you know, I knew tons of people who really, really killed themselves organizing those super rallies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think sometimes it just takes away from local organizing, assuming that they are doing local organizing. And I just have a very strong sense that, you know, at the end of the day this time, because of the loathing of Bush, which is very understandable, the numbers would be poor and people would be disheartened.
That's certainly my sense as well. We're talking to Alexander Coburn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have lines open if you'd like to call in. 333-9455 is our main line, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller. So, Urbana, line one, you're on the air with Alexander Coburn.
Yeah, thanks. Enjoying the conversation. I'm sure a lot of other people are as well. I just had two questions. One is, has Alexander been following the whole brouhaha about the possibility of tampering when voting becomes electronic?
Mm-hmm.
And number two is a little more complicated, so maybe you'd like to answer that one first.
Yeah, I've been following him. I think the capacity for fraud is there. I mean, you know, I mean, you have these politicians who turned out to be involved in the electronic machines, and then where there's a will, there's a way. And since the incentive of every politician is to try and jimmy the vote in their favor somehow, even by suppressing the vote and telling people to stay at home except for his own shock or her own shock troops, I think it is very worrying.
Alex, where do you come down on the 2000 presidential election? Do you think that Gore actually won Florida and had it
yes,
taken?
Yes, I do. I think Gore did win Florida, and I think he should have won the College of Heralds, and the U.S. Supreme Court saved him.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Could I ask one other question?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. And the other question is, while I was listening to you earlier, I just put up LexisNexis on the computer, and I typed in your name to see how often it was cited, first in the major papers, and it was like cited five times. And then I put it in the magazines and journals, and this time that was in 6 months. And then under magazines, I put it in for 5 years, and it only showed up seven times, and only once from The Nation. And I'm curious because it seems to me that people like Mr. Coburn and I are kind of screened out of this huge archive, and I was curious if he had any, if he could enlighten us on how it is, how his material is either put on or not put on. Something
that's
like
interesting.
That.
I'm a little puzzled because I do a syndicated column which goes to at least 20 major newspapers, and I'm not saying they publish it every week. But, for example, I think you said you looked at the last 5 years. I don't know if that was for newspapers.
That was 6 months for newspapers and 5 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm in a bunch of newspapers in around the country, you know, like the, you know, middle-tier newspapers or the L.A. Times, I mean, on a weekly basis. So I'm not quite sure why it's not showing up. I mean, actually, I'm genuinely puzzled. And I'm not saying that these are citations in the major press, really, you're saying.
Well, put quotes around your name and keyed
yeah.
on, you know.
I mean, I can see that. I mean, the papers don't spend their time citing the great name of Coburn, but I should just come up as a guy who wrote columns. I mean, of course, I'm in The Nation every two weeks.
You should just come up with all the people who attack you, Alex. I mean.
Yeah, well, I should have. I mean, after all, Dershowitz has been running around. You know, I was saying that the charge of anti-Semite has been kind of devalued. I mean, for example, Eric Alterman, my colleague at The Nation, he spent a lot of the time saying, I'm an anti-Semite, and someone asked him why, and he said, well, he attacked Irving Howe. So, I mean, so it's kind of bringing a word which actually once meant something down to a pretty low level. And, of course, Dershowitz, after I'd said he was a plagiarist, he said I was an anti-Semite immediately. So if you're a plagiarist, anti-Semite, so I can't really, back in the 1970s when people brought out this club to hit you on the head with it, I mean, it really meant something a little different. It was, you know, you felt kind of really furious about it. To be called a Jew hater is completely disgusting and abhorrent. But now, I mean, it's just people have got so reflexively throwing the word around. Anyway, that's kind of going back to what we said before. As for LexisNexis, I don't know. Maybe if you went to Google, you'd find something different.
Yeah, try Google.
Okay, but please don't let LexisNexis get away with it. I mean, please check
out. Oh, I know. I'm going to send out the search parties right now.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. Okay, Alex, let's mention to our listeners again that the new book that you've co-edited with Jeffrey St. Clair is called The Politics of Anti-Semitism, and you can find out information about it by going to the www.counterpunch.org website or calling, what's the number again?
1-800- 1-800-840-3683. And, of course, it's up on Amazon. It's a nice book, and we published it as Counterpunch in association with AK Press, which is the anarchist publishing house based in Oakland, who are a very nice bunch of people. And it's a very nice-looking book, actually.
You know, what's your take on what's happening in Iraq now with the U.S. occupation? You know, the Bush administration in the last couple of weeks has now come out and said that the news media, perhaps reflecting a liberal bias, is giving a very incorrect view of how well the occupation is going, making it seem like there's actually it's a tough occupation when, in fact, it's going swimmingly. What's the truth there to what you know?
I think it's a pretty pretty hard to say it's going swimmingly. It's an absolute disaster on every level. I mean, everything that the critics said what would happen has happened. And I don't think I think a lot of critics thought that there might be some weapons of mass destruction. My position was always, I always thought to myself, although I didn't think there were, just because of, you know, what Saddam's son-in-law Kamal had said when he defected back in the middle 90s, I thought it was unlikely there'd be any, but, you know, I just said, well, so what if they had some, you know, but the U.S. has got them, Israel's got them, France has got them, why can't a country? My position is every country should have one bomb, nuclear bomb, just for the sake of the peace. This is not a popular position on the left, so maybe we'll get a call about it. But, I mean, look at how they treated North Korea with a little respect when they said they had a nuclear bomb. I don't think they do, but... No, in Iraq, I think it's an absolute disaster. My brother, Patrick, who writes for The Independent, we run his stories quite often on our website. I mean, he's telling in stories now where they're going out now and destroying, by way of reprisals, they went to a village and destroyed some olive orchards because, I mean, they suspected that the locals had been involved in the killing of a U.S. serviceman. That's not exactly going to build up love and support for the United States. They can't make the place run. I mean, that's the main thing. I mean, that happened right after the hot war, so to speak, was over. They just couldn't get the things fired up. And I think a lot of Iraqis who felt positive and felt happy that Saddam had gone and so on and so forth, now, you know, their money's not worth a dime in their pockets. Nothing's working. The place seems to be gradually going to rack and ruin, incredibly high crime rates, great personal, physical lack of security, devaluation, and so on and so forth. They're all furious. So it's not a success story. And if you look at see what their plans for Iraqi agriculture are, of course, they're planning basically to do a privatization, along the usual lines, theft of public assets and giving them to their cronies in U.S. firms and the like.
Alex, we've got a few callers. Let's try. We only got about 8 minutes left, so let's try to get to the lines if we can. Champagne, you're on the air with Alex Coburn.
Thank you. I don't mean this question to be confrontational, necessarily, but and I agree it's about 80% what you're saying, not that every nation should have a nuclear weapon. But if I couch it this way, the New York Times, which I read, and the Economist, and a few other...
It's a little hard to... I can't hear you very well. Can you talk a little slower?
All right. Well... like I said, I essentially agree with you with about 80% of what you say.
Good.
Not about every nation having a nuclear weapon, which I suppose you say tongue-in-cheek. In any event, my question, if I couch it this way, like, I think Krugman paints a real good picture of the economic system, which more or less is a crooked card game, which he more or less states. What I'd like to couch to you is a thought that the left and the liberal establishment isn't well represented in terms of what's practical, in terms of, like, for instance, the last election when you backed Nader, or that ilk back Nader, that was a bad move politically. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could say how you think your ideas could come into the mainstream enough so that it could be politically viable. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Okay, I'm going to let you take that, Alex.
It was a little fuzzy for some reason. I think what you're saying at the end is that the ideas that I support can get into the mainstream?
Yeah, I think that basically is it.
And he was critical of my criticism of Krugman. Well, my feeling about Krugman, just to answer the two in tandem, I mean, I think Krugman says that the Bush years have shown a system that's tilted towards the rich people. But Krugman does not say the same of the Clinton years. And now remember that Krugman himself, for example, was an ardent advocate of deregulation in the energy field, witness the fact that he was a consultant for Enron. I mean, now he says he kind of does a disclosure which implies that, like, they went and asked him how to add two and two. Does it make four or does it make five? And he told them as a trained economist. It was a bit more serious than that. He was a big promoter of Enron, and he got $50,000 a year, I think, from him. I don't know how, for how long. I don't think there was anything underhand about it, by the way. Don't get me wrong, but I just mean that if Krugman in the late 90s was on board for Enron, which was basically, even before we knew all the scams that were going on, was clearly an attempt to remove a lot of the energy field from public supervision and allow them the so-called mechanisms of the marketplace to govern energy prices. And, of course, we all know what happened to that in California. None better than Governor Gray Davis, who lost his job because of that, deservedly so, in my opinion. Krugman's idea of what a lopsided, a rigged game is pretty limited. He's disingenuous about, you know, how rigged it is, that the whole system, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, the system is rigged. And I, again, urge you to go read Bob Polin's book, published by Verso, Figures of Dissent. That's Dissent, D-E-S-C-E-N-T, will show you. Now, as for getting ideas in the mainstream, look, all you can do is say what you think in as many venues as you can, I mean, on our website, in syndicated columns, in the nations, and hope that seepage will gradually put things out. I think it happens much slower than you'd want to. As for being, that's what else can you do? I mean, you can't put a gun to people's head and say, read this and remember it and think I'm wonderful. It's not going to work very well. And as for every country having a nuclear bomb, not really. I'd rather support that position, actually. I think, you know, the disarmament thing just hasn't worked at all. Since 1945, the nuclear club's not going to disarm. I think if every country had a nuclear device of some sort, it would be a marvelously chastening effect and beneficial to world peace.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines on that note. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Alex Coburn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to get back to anti-Semitism because I think there is something real there, and to discount it is dangerous. I think there's real anti-Semitism, whether it's on the right or on the left, whether it's in Muslim or Christian or other societies. But it's important to be able to distinguish between, let me give an example, disagreeing with the policies of an Israeli government or disagreeing with the existence of the State of Israel or of a Jewish society. The first is a political position. The second is a political position, but it also tinges into anti-Semitism. I mean, very much like having literature in the Arab world, which very much takes anti-Semitism as an accepted position, or the position of the prime minister of, I don't know if he was the prime minister or the president of Malaysia, Mahathir, or various other individuals. So I think
there's anti-Semitism in the world. I think, obviously, I think there's Jew hatred in the world and in Arab countries, and for reasons you can readily appreciate. As far as Mahathir, the Malaysian prime minister, is concerned, I mean, a lot of what he said was actually, I didn't think was so exceptional. For example, he led off all his statements by saying 6 million died in the Holocaust. And then he said he actually was advocating a peaceful path. He said the Jews have done really well. I think the line that probably did trend to anti-Semitism was the bit about getting other people to go do the fighting and dying. Well, although, of course, I did remember that when people were writing about the pro-Israel lobby like Wolfowitz, that was constantly pointed out that a lot of these people never did do any form of military service. So I guess you could even, on a narrow effort, say that. I didn't think what he said was so terrible, frankly. But I think the main thing is that anti-Semitism is on the wane. I was at a meeting the other day, and people were saying, you know, do you think Lieberman would ever be president? And Scott Handelman, one of the contributors to our book, by the way, who's a nice Jewish boy from Miami Beach, said, well, look, Lieberman actually was a heartbeat away from the presidency. He's an Orthodox Jew. I mean, 30 years ago, there were signs on the beaches in Florida saying no dogs, no Jews. I mean, around the world now, there are hundreds of Holocaust memorials. I just was in London, where the Imperial War Museum, which has five floors to it, the top two floors are actually a Holocaust museum now. I mean, I think one of the things that Scott deals with in his essay in the book is this question, which, of course, Hannah Arendt addressed, is there something permanent in the human condition called anti-Semitism, or is anti-Semitism something that was in history, bulked enormously large in the late 19th and 20th centuries with absolutely horrifying results, and is it on the wane now? I personally believe it's on the wane. Does that mean people say, well, what about France? To which the fact of the matter is that in France, the anti-Semitism is really against Arabs. Would you rather be a Jew or an Arab in France? I think you'd rather be a Jew. And the actual quantitative number of attacks, and all of which are deplorable, by the way, is not that great. Where's the fastest growing Jewish community in Europe? It's in Germany. So, someone I'll go
out. Alex, you know what? I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means I'm going to have to get out of the studio pretty soon.
Off you go. Get out
of
here.
Yeah, well, look, Alex Coburn's been our guest today in Media Matters. He is the co-editor with Jeff St. Clair of the new book, The Politics of Anti-Semitism, co-editor of Counterpunch. You can go find it at www.counterpunch.org. Thank you, Alex, for being our guest, and I'll be back in a week. Thank you all for joining us.